The Bloodstream Podcast, episode 39, is brought to you by our presenting sponsor, Takeda. And for that, we say, thanks Takeda.
Hello, and welcome to the Bloodstream Podcast, episode 39, August 19th, 2019. I am Patrick James Lynch.
And I'm Natalie Lynch.
On this episode, what's the deal with CBD oil, and is gun control a healthcare issue? Those questions are addressed in our like and comment segments. Dr. Austin Chang joins us to talk health information and social media in the interview segment. Debbie's back with another moment for mental health. Meredith Myers is here for the first time with a community share piece that she calls first of his kind. Mama Sue's still watching TV that she talks about. We got a lot of announcements. There's so much going on. Let's just get into it. Welcome to Bloodstream.
How the F is it August?
I mean, it just happens that way. Every year it flies. It really, really flies. I actually felt like July, for me anyway, was slower than usual.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we don't have kids yet, but it's like, it's already back to school. I saw this week, my cousin's kids are already back in school.
Where do they live?
California, Northern California.
It's
They're
August.
Back in school.
It's, yeah. We're recording this on the 6th.
I know.
Okay.
Isn't that insane?
Yes. When do they get out? February?
I don't know. And I was going to message them. It was like, Liam's first day of school. And I was like, wait, what?
That's bizarre to me.
Yeah, it was last week. Which would have been July.
What's crazy, though, is like whenever we do programs that involve teenagers and we get to this around the summer, it's like there's some schools that are like, oh, they're done like after March. And you're like, what? And then there's other schools that are going until June. Then yeah. There's schools that are back in August. And then there's schools that are not back until it feels like the end of September.
And I'm pretty sure their school's not a year-round school that does like small breaks, because I know some schools do that. But okay. Like, I think this is like a regular school year school that, yeah, like goes back at August.
All right. Well, I don't know.
Welcome back. To school.
I guess so.
This is our back to school episode where we talk nothing about back to school, but I'm just calling it that. But what are we going to be talking about? What's an exciting thing that's coming out this month?
Well, yeah. So there's a lot that we're going to get into in the meat of this thing, but some housekeeping. Stop the Bleeding is out. Season 9 launched on, we just told you that it's August 6th when we're recording. So now I'm going to pretend like you didn't hear that. And I'm going to say it came out last week.
6 days ago on August 13th.
And was a great smash success. It went super well. Everyone loved it. You guys saw it, right? You went to stbhemo.com to watch the first episode of season 9?
Why are there crickets?
Go to stbhemo.com. You can watch the first episode of season 9 right now. It's there live. And on Tuesday, you'll get the second episode with the return of one of my favorite characters of all time. We haven't seen him since season 1, episode 1.
What?
Bleedotron. That's right. Just get ready.
I haven't seen anything yet.
You have not. Yeah, you have not, which is kind of fun. I've resisted the temptation to want to share anything with you.
I got ants in my pants.
Well, that's a different kind of problem. if you're on facebook.com/stbhemo, if you want to check us out there as well, we're also at stbhemo on Instagram and the YouTube channel where you can find all Stop the Bleeding and this content and everything in video form is Bloodfeed. Actually, it's kind of annoying though. You got to go to youtube.com/believedigi, because that's what we decided 7 years ago, and we changed the vanity link, and but we can't change believedigi. So you go there, it says Bloodfeed, everything's Bloodfeed, but the darn link has to be believedigi. So that's just what it is. But if you go look up Stop the Bleeding, you'll find it. Also, other announcement, speaking of back to school, this actually has some kind of like school-like something to it. The Science Fair. Talked about that a few times on this podcast. TheSciencefair.org. It's an up and running website right at this very moment. But tomorrow, in real time, on the 20th, August 20th, we're going to have some new stuff up on the website in anticipation of our BDC premiere coming up in October. The Science Fair has been a huge part of Believe's work this year. Very proud of what we've done. And we're sharing some like cool behind the scenes drawings, and there's some video. The advisors, our scientific advisory council, to put this thing together. So some neat stuff if you're into that kind of thing and you're nerdy like me. Our inhibitor series I've talked about, I feel like for forever, because we've kind of been working on it for like forever. But we're finally at a point where it's time to come out. And I'm really excited about that because it's really good. So I'm happy it's we're at this stage. It's going to be coming out not on this RSS feed. So if you are subscribed to the Bloodstream podcast, which of course you are, right? You're subscribed.
At this point, they better be.
Are those the crickets again?
Come on, guys.
Make sure to go to Apple Podcasts, Bloodstream Podcast.
Episode 39.
How many more do we have to do?
Program.
But unfortunately, you'll also have to subscribe to Bloodline Pod or go to bloodlinepod.com where you will find the Inhibitor series. That's going to be coming out on August 26th, September 2nd, and September 9th. So again, August 26th, September 2nd, September 9th, bloodlinepod.com. Just a couple of things I want to mention. Alex Dowsett completed the Tour de France. He is a cyclist with hemophilia, and he just biked a whole heck of a lot all through France. So congratulations to Alex on that awesome, awesome, awesome achievement and for continuing to do what he can to shout out and support people who are living with bleeding disorders. Our friends over at Save One Life, they are in Africa at the moment. They'll be back by the time this comes out. And another one of our friends will be in Africa for a different reason. But they are there in part to, some of them are climbing Mount Kilimanjaro as a fundraiser to raise funds for Save One Life. Lori's leading a team of about 10-ish people. A lot of photos online on the Save One Life Facebook page and Instagram accounts. And our buddy Chris is also there doing the good work of Save One Life, meeting with local leaders. I don't know the specific ins and outs of his trip, but he's there doing something a little bit more, you know, day to day and not climbing. He's not the one climbing the mountain this time. So, you know, life moves on. As always, I encourage you to check out the latest episode of Ask the Expert. You can subscribe. Wow.
Are you trying to create a new beat? That's what it sounded like. Mikey, can we replay that back a bunch of times? I loved that.
You can subscribe.
It's going to be our new opening to our show.
Oh, no.
Do it again. Do it again.
I can't.
Okay. Well, so what do you want to say?
That was amazing. That was unsettling. You can subscribe to the Ask the Expert podcast as well. If you haven't already, please do. Look, I can barely talk. Like, I've got nothing left. I'm giving you everything. I can't subscribe. Just please do it. On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, SoundCloud, we are wherever you listen to podcasts. And if we're not there, come yell at us. Mailbag at bloodstreampod.com. What's that?
That made me think of, like, that we were in Westworld and you were like fritzing out, like you were.
Oh yeah. What's that guy's name? I don't remember. Dolores. I want to say Ken because he's like Ken from like Barbie and Ken, but that, I know. But yeah. Him. He's a good actor. I liked his turn in season. He was the best part of season two. You know us. We're on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. If there's something you want to hear us talk about, if you're interested in contributing to our share segment, or if you just want to say hello, we are listening. Mailbag at bloodstreammedia.com. Find us on social media or send a carrier pigeon. It might take a while, but if we get it, we will respond. Next, we have our episode 39 like segment. But before we get started with the like segment, Natalie, we want to thank this week's sponsor, Genentech, who created the Challenge Accepted show, an exciting web series I've spoken about before to you. You've heard me. Hosted by magician and comedian Justin Willman, Challenge Accepted shines a spotlight on real members of the Hemophilia A community as they work alongside celebrity coaches to overcome their everyday challenges and get outside their comfort zones. So check it out. Some of the celebrity coaches include Chef Elliot Graham and even my good friend, Alex Borstein. The entire Challenge Accepted series is available right now, and you can find it by searching the phrase Challenge Accepted Show on YouTube. You have to use the whole phrase. Or click the link in the program notes. And with that, we move on to the like segment. Natalie?
So this month on the like segment, we're going to be talking about CBD oil again. We talked about it a year ago in episode 27, last August.
It's like our anniversary.
It is. You know, every August we talk about CBD.
So why are we talking about it this August if we talked about it last August?
Well, an article on CBD oil came out in HemaWare last month or this month. I'm not sure when it was published.
In the most recent HemaWare, anyway.
The most recent one. What's the deal with CBD oil? And so, you know, I kind of took a look to see what has changed in the conversation since we talked about it last year to this year. And a few articles, a New York Times article came out last October, a few months after we brought it up on the pod.
You think we inspired it?
I think we did. I think we have a lot of New York Times editors who are in our listenership. Mm-hmm. And I think they're like, well, if Bloodstream's talking about it, New York Times probably should.
Yeah, I'm glad that we have that impact on the news cycle.
Yeah, it's So the New York Times last October wrote an article, "Why is CBD everywhere?" And I think that is probably the most the biggest change in the last 12 months is that I know I've seen it everywhere.
I just can't help but like picture my own mother just like, well, why is CBD everywhere? Why is it everywhere? But why is it everywhere? It's at the gas station. Why is it everywhere?
That's exactly. Exactly. But I think, you know, people are seeing it literally everywhere. Water with CBD, bath bombs with CBD, lip balm with CBD. Everything has CBD in it. And people are, you know, is it legal? And it's interesting because it really teeters this line. Because to make CBD most effective, it should be combined with trace amounts of THC. And THC is scheduled one. I mean, marijuana is a scheduled one narcotic here in the United States federally.
Right there with heroin.
You know, very, very similar risks.
Yeah, very logical.
But yeah, so there are, you know, each state has its own regulations, but this is really just showing up everywhere right now. So, you know, I doubt at this point there's that many people who are like, what is CBD oil? That seems to be a discussion past. But for those of you who are like, well, you know, I'm feeling shy about raising my hand in the back.
Not everybody is a New York Times editor listening to the pod religiously.
So it is cannabinoid, which...
Nice job. I can never get that out on a first try.
Thanks. Yeah, you know, nice. I struggle with other words, but... you know, I got my cannabis words down pat now. And it is, cannabidiol is what CBD, that's what it's short for. So, it is found in the cannabis plant and it is not, a cannabinoid that makes you high or has, you know, any kind of psychotropic or mind altering, effects. But what it has been, shown to do is, relieve anxiety, help with chronic pain. And then this year, in the last 12 months, or year and a half rather, a seizure drug came out. And we did talk about that a year ago, that there is now an FDA approved drug in seizures. And you can actually Google and see the difference it makes in kids with different forms of epilepsy who otherwise, we're not reacting to any other kind of drugs. And, you know, it's pretty dramatic. It's pretty intense to see and pretty exciting to see that it works. So we definitely will have links in the program notes. The one lookout that has come up, you know, is CBD safe? And is it safe for our community primarily? And there have been studies showing that it may have an anticoagulant effect by suppressing the production of blood platelets, which is obviously a concern with anyone with a bleeding disorder. So if this is something you're considering, it may be worth talking to your doctor about. In November of last year, the American Society of Regional Anesthetics and Pain Medicine released an article discussing about the anticoagulation issues with multiple cannabinoids. So we'll have that link in the program notes as well if you want to read a little bit further about that. But it seems like all these studies are pretty young because it wasn't until, I believe, 2015 where even the research on this was being allowed. So it's all quite new.
And, you know, maybe as just a final point, you had mentioned something to me off mic about some cultural societal reasons that we might be seeing CBD everywhere, so to speak, or might be seeing it on the rise in addition to just kind of, you know, the momentum of bringing something new into the world. But it being so ubiquitously available, or at least so it seems, might not be quite so coincidental, right?
Yeah, there have been waves in the past, post-war waves where sedatives, you know, mother's little helper pills were very popular. And then with the release of antidepressants in the 1980s, you know, another cultural wave of Prozac. And, you know, so I think with what's going on politically and culturally and with healthcare, there's a lot of anxiety right now. People are very, very anxious. And CBD is very vogue. And people seem, you know, from an anecdotal perspective seem to really find relief with it. So, you know, it may or may not work for you. And if it's something you're interested in, I think you should talk to your doctor about it. But another interesting point before we wrap up is one of the concerns is it is not classified as a medicine right now. It's classified as a dietary supplement. The FDA does not regulate dietary supplements. So the amount that it's stated on the bottle or on the label or in the ingredient list is not necessarily what is in there. And also other substances that may not be disclosed could be in there because of the lack of regulation. So one, you know, pro tip would be to buy from a company who has a third party verification and, you know, and that publishes on their website those results. That's always important. So yeah, it's interesting, but you know, it's a topic and it's everywhere.
It sure is. All right. Links in the program notes. Thank you, Natalie, very much for presenting that today. And thanks once again to Genentech, the sponsor of the Like segment for this month. We want to thank them and we want to remind you that you can check out the new Challenge Accepted show on YouTube by searching for, get this, Challenge Accepted show on YouTube.
Welcome to A Moment from Mental Health, our monthly conversation that breaks down stigma and provides a safe space about things that matter. Our goal in this segment is to break mental, emotional, and behavioral health down into its various pieces, and in each episode, focus on just one or two of those pieces. As always, I'm joined today by Bloodstream contributor Debbie De La Riva, who is a licensed professional counselor with Mental Health Matters 2 based out of Houston, Texas. As always, Debbie, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you. It's always been a pleasure.
Today, we have a heavy but critical topic. Coming up in September is Suicide Prevention Month. And during this month's segment, we wanted to touch on the importance of bringing awareness to suicide prevention and some warning signs to look out for. Debbie, this is so important. And why is creating awareness around suicide prevention becoming a conversation?
Yeah, it's because in general, people are becoming aware of it and aware of the fact that it's increasing. In fact, it's at an all-time high, the rate of suicide, which is a 14 out of 100,000 people. It's never been this high since World War II. And the other thing is that the significant jump, it's a significant jump. It's 33%. We're having a higher rate of suicide at 33% since 2000. I want to give people a perspective of numbers, Amy. It's 47,000 people we lost in 2017 to suicide, which really breaks down to 120 per day. Not only that, as we're seeing the trend now, especially among young adults, 18 to 24, that this is the second leading cause of death for that age range. When you look at it with adults, it's a 10th leading cause of death. And more specifically, it's actually called the age of despair because we're finding out that there's an increase. The age group that's at a higher risk of dying by suicide is our white middle-aged men. In fact, they account for 7 out of 10 suicide completions. So more awareness, but the sad fact is increasing.
The American Foundation for Suicide Prevention mentions both warning signs for loved ones to look out for and also risk factors of suicide. Can you break those down for us? What are some of the warning signs that loved ones and family and friends should look out for?
Yeah, I want to break it down in terms of ways that it's easier to remember. It really has a lot to do with the language. If somebody is saying that they're feeling hopeless or helpless or trapped, they are feeling that they're a burden to society or that there's really no reason for them to be here, this lack of purpose. But the biggest thing people have to really understand is that if somebody is talking or writing about suicide, we have to take that as serious and address this. So, and then you can look at behavior. You know, people who are beginning to withdraw from others or they used to come to community events and now we don't see them anymore. A dramatic change in mood in any form, meaning if somebody used to be kind of melancholic and sad and all of a sudden they're happy and engaged with people. Another change is that mild manner person who then is beginning to act kind of aggressive and angry. Increased use of alcohol or drugs is a big telltale sign. But a lot of people know about the other ones, and that is about giving away their possessions. And, of course, if somebody is seeking the means, if somebody who's never owned a gun is beginning to buy guns or anything else that seems illegal. But do you know what the biggest warning signs are, Amy? Yeah, it's those people that have an organized plan, and they've either had a previous attempt, or there's a history of suicide in their families. Those are the big signs.
So the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention also mentions risk factors. How is that different from warning signs? And can you help us understand some of these risk factors?
Yeah, the risk factors are things that just make it more likely that you would be someone to attempt suicide, different from the actual warning signs. One of the risk factors is gender. Men statistically are 3 times more likely to die by suicide. But it's also important to know that women make more attempts. Just men tend to seek out the means that are more lethal. Another really important risk factor we need to know about is mental illness, depression, anxiety. Because 9 out of 10 deaths by suicide is a result of someone who's either been diagnosed or should have been diagnosed with those disorders. Another risk factor is alcohol and substance abuse, especially opioid use. In fact, that's really what they're saying. That's the increased risk of suicide has having a lot to do with the opioid use. And the thing that our community members need to understand is that those who have a chronic illness, especially associated with pain, it's also a risk factor.
So what can we all do in the month of September to join in the fight for growing awareness of suicide prevention?
Yeah, what I'd like to encourage people to do is get the suicide hotlines on their phones. So if they're ever in that situation, it's right there. So it's suicide prevention hotline. It's 800-273-TALK. There's even a crisis line. It's called, you would put connect to 741-741 and the Trevor Project. They have a Trevor hotline. Here's the idea. Ask the question. That's how you know if somebody's feeling suicidal. You ask them, are you having thoughts of killing yourself? Because what happens is a lot of people think that plants the idea in their mind. But what it really does is allow people that space and that to talk about it and to prevent it. You would then ask them, how are you going to do it? When have you sought the means to do so? You also want to encourage people to get screenings. And there's a free confidential screening at Mental Health America. And really encourage people to tell their docs not only what they're feeling physically, but mentally what they're going through. But the last thing that we can all do is just reassure somebody who's in this dark place having these thoughts, that these are normal feelings. It's okay to have these feelings. And it's the wave. We consider suicidal thoughts as waves. And just remind them that it's going to get better.
Debbie, thank you so much for joining us today. I think this information is extremely important. And I encourage our listeners out there to be mindful with your friends and families and relationships. Ask those questions, even though it feels uncomfortable, and know that there is support around you, in particular with the bleeding disorder community. Thank you again, Debbie. All of the resources and the hotlines that Debbie mentioned today are going to be in the podcast liner notes, so you guys will have that information. Please check out the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention's website. It's very comprehensive. Check out Debbie's website as well, www.mentalhealthmatters2.com. Debbie has a phenomenal resource guide on her website that's very comprehensive, and make sure to check that out. Thank you again, Debbie, and we will talk to you next month.
Good. Thank you, and thank you for what you're doing with this podcast.
we once again want to thank our presenting sponsor, Takeda. And you can learn more about Takeda's commitment to the bleeding disorders community and the resources they have to offer at bleedingdisorders.com. Even I can remember that. I don't have to write it down. It's not spelled weird. Bleedingdisorders.com. So easy. And now for this episode's community share segment. This one comes to us from Meredith Myers in a piece called First of His Kind, about her story of learning that her son had hemophilia when she had no documented family history. But she'll tell you about that herself.
First of his kind. With no documented family history, my husband and I first learned about hemophilia when our son Carson was diagnosed at 11 months old. Around 9 months old, he started bruising really easily, and those bruises would have bumps in the middle of them. At his well-child checkup, we asked his doctor what could be causing these, and he was stumped. They ordered blood tests for cancer, which came back negative. Over the course of several months, we did blood test after blood test. We even did an x-ray, but everything came back negative. My husband and I were getting frustrated, and the doctor suggested one last blood test. The Friday after the last blood draw, Carson cut his knee when he was crawling around on the floor, and it would not stop bleeding. I finally got it to stop after an hour of solid pressure. The next morning, I took off the Band-Aid along with the scab, so it started bleeding again. Since it was a Saturday, I didn't want to take him to the ER for something small, so I went to a nearby urgent care instead. I explained to the doctor what had happened, and the first thing he asked was, "Does Carson have hemophilia?" I had no idea what that was, so I said no, but a seed had been planted. The following Monday, we get a phone call from our doctor saying that the test came back negative and that we had to wait 2 more weeks before we could try again. We didn't want to wait 2 weeks, so we decided to try another doctor that we had heard wonderful things about. We told her what happened at the urgent care and that we would like to test for hemophilia. After looking at Carson's chart, the doctor informed us that our previous doctor was close to calling Child Protective Services on us. She warned us that if the hemophilia test result came back negative, she was bound to call CPS as well. Thankfully, it never came to that. On November 19th, 2012, Carson was diagnosed with severe hemophilia A. We were referred to Misty Peds in Boise, Idaho, which is about 45 minutes away from where we were living at the time. The appointment day came, and we had so many questions, but at the same time, we didn't know where to start. I remember the first thing Dr. Meeker told us was that this isn't a death sentence like it was years ago. Your son can live a normal, happy life with the new medicine they are coming out with. We decided to go with the port for Carson since he needed his medicine 3 times a week, and we wanted to preserve his veins for when he is older. While we were waiting for surgery day, I had my blood drawn to see where Carson got the hemophilia from. Was it just a gene mutation in him, or was there some hidden family history we didn't know about? Well, news came back that the gene mutation came from me. Finding out that I was the one that gave this to my son made me feel guilty, also frustrated that I was a carrier my whole life and didn't know it. Surgery day came, and I was so nervous. Having my baby boy that wasn't even one undergo major surgery was stressful, but he did so well. While he was recovering, the HDC nurse taught us how to access Carson's port. It was so overwhelming, I didn't want to get it wrong and potentially hurt my little man. It took a few tries, but I got the hang of it. We knew from the HDC that there was a local chapter for support and education. In the beginning, we weren't quite ready for that. Everything was brand new, a little overwhelming, and very confusing. It wasn't until a few months after port surgery that we went to our first educational dinner, and since that dinner, we have met so many new people that understood what our new life was like. Over the years, we have attended fundraising events, walks, and family summer camps together. We have bonded over similar stories of caretaker burnout, problems with our kids' schools, issues getting factor approved with insurance, and our kids not wanting to be different. Through these experiences, we have gained a small but close group that we call our hemophilia family.
All right, so this is interesting. This month's comment segment is from an article that was published Thursday, August 1st, 2019. It's an article that we chose to do for this podcast on Thursday, August 1st, 2019, not knowing that 2 and 3 days later, A combined 31 people would be murdered in two horrific gun rampages in Ohio and Texas. So that is coincidence, but I don't know. America 2019, there seems like there's always something gun related to refer to. Anyway, I say all that because I think it's important, number one, that you just have that context. We chose this before what happened, and we're not changing course. In fact, I think it just makes the points of views that we will represent here, Natalie and I momentarily, all the more important to digest. And secondly, there's another important piece of this that I myself keep forgetting about, which is the discussion around gun violence and suicide. September is Suicide Prevention Month. We do a lot for mental health, or at least we try, on Bloodstream. So that's an important point as well, and one that I don't want to get overshadowed, given that the conversation around gun control has certainly, we'll just say, changed since we originally chose to do this piece for a different purpose. So with that being said, I'm going to give a little bit of background, and then we're going to go into Natalie and I are going to play a little game. We're going to play a little play acting game. This article that we're looking at here is from ASH, the American Society of Hematology, their clinical news. And it asks that question, is gun control a healthcare issue, to two hematologists, Dr. Alan Lichten, who is from the Cleveland Clinic, and Dr. Bart Scott, who is from the University of Washington and the Seattle Cancer Care Alliance. These two gentlemen have different points of view on if gun control is a healthcare issue. But more specifically, in October of 2018, the American College of Physicians, the ACP, clarified their stance on whether gun control should be treated as a public health issue. They offered a firearms policy paper. It had 9 evidence-based strategies for reducing firearm-related injuries and deaths by keeping guns out of the hands of those at risk for harming themselves or others. Shortly after that, the NRA tweeted out a link to the article, criticized the ACP, writing, quote, "Someone should tell self-important anti-gun doctors to stay in their lane." That tweet prompted a viral response from doctors and healthcare professionals saying, well, this is our lane. In fact, hashtag this is our lane, given the aftermath of caring for patients who were victims of gun violence. So that seems to have kind of led to a lot of other activity amongst certain science and physician societies and organizations on what the appropriate action to take really is. And it's interesting to even think what that thinking may have been just less than a week ago from the time that we're recording this. So what we'll do now is, Natalie, you have been cast in the role of Dr. Alan Lichten from the Cleveland Clinic. How do you feel about that?
Well, it's my first time playing a man.
Oh, wow. Big day.
But we're both from Cleveland, so I think I can pull it off. I know what men from Cleveland are like.
All right, we're not going to go any further into that. And I will be playing Dr. Bart Scott from the University of Washington. And both of these gentlemen will be addressing the question, is gun control a healthcare issue? We will start with Dr. Alan Lichten.
Gun violence is a very worrisome cultural phenomenon. People who are shot, depending on the part of the body, can require massive amounts of blood for transfusion. Blood's a resource that's not readily available in many locations. Blood banks are good about providing blood, but one gunshot wound to the liver, for example, can deplete a blood bank. So yes, guns are a healthcare issue from that perspective. As a society, we need to do better in finding out who these people are before they hurt so many others.
Yes, hi, Dr. Bart Scott here. I'm an MD. Personally, I think we should recognize that gun violence is primarily driven by suicides. 2/3 of deaths from gun violence are suicide attempts. Guns are an inanimate object. Death is an issue, and suicide is an issue. There was never a question that suicide is a healthcare issue. It is primarily a mental health issue, but with violent means of suicide attempts, a bleeding issue. The debate is not about whether suicide is a healthcare issue, but about whether physicians and medical societies should take a political position on gun control. I would support any hematologist getting involved with any political debate he or she wishes to be involved with. There is a difference, though, between an individual physician being involved versus a collective organization. If a professional society gets involved, it invariably will be seen as a partisan issue. When that occurs, it will diminish the potential role that an organization has in the issues with which it should be more directly involved. For ASH, that means funding for research of blood cancers and blood diseases.
ASH represents hematologists. When I was the chair of the Society's Committee on Government Affairs, we debated this, and I appreciated the idea that maybe ASH, representing all hematologists, should not weigh in on this issue. However, there are many hematologists who feel that gun safety is something that our organization should take a position on. The vote was split, but the majority did vote in favor of signing onto the ACP's initial call to action. While ASH debates this issue, other medical professional societies have come forward with positions to change the way guns are handled, bought, and sold in this country. I believe ASH should look at what the other organizations are doing and decide whether it's time for ASH to agree or not, as the representative body of hematologists.
Also, there are other public health issues that are more pressing from the standpoint of how they affect global health. For example, childhood obesity is much more of a threat to overall health in the U.S. I am sure most of our readers, ASH readers, are aware of the Dickey Amendment, a provision in the 1996 federal omnibus spending bill that restricts the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention from performing research on projects that are seen as advancing or promoting gun control. I would say, however, that research on the causes of suicide is very important, and we need to be careful with the language that we use.
I think if a researcher wants to examine a topic, he or she should not be inhibited by law to do that research. In terms of thwarting human progress, the idea of laws that prevent research is a bad one. If it is a moral or ethical dilemma, like research with fetal or embryo tissue, that's a different discussion. Research on guns, gang violence, suicide, the use of guns by anyone motivated by hate. Personally, I think that type of research could be very valuable. Research is being done in this area within private institutions. There's a 2018 study about blood use and mortality in victims of gun violence published in Transfusion. The conclusions were that compared with other traumatic injuries, gunshot wound injuries are associated with substantially greater blood utilization and mortality. Trauma centers treating gunshot wound injuries should have ready access to all blood components and the ability to implement massive transfusions. I think further research into this nationwide may benefit us all.
I want to be clear. I do not promote restrictions on research. That goes against my own personal philosophy, but I am stating the official position regarding CDC's stance on research for gun violence. People are changing the gun control debate for political expediency. As a scientific organization, ASH should not go along with that approach. Yes, we should do everything we can to support suicide prevention, which is primarily related to mental health issues. There is no question that gun-related suicide has a major impact on healthcare costs. Information from the Suicide Prevention Resource Center indicates that the average cost of one suicide is $1.3 million, and the total cost of suicides and suicide attempts in 2015 was $93.5 billion with a B dollars. That's a lot of money.
I view it from the perspective of a hematologist treating patients with leukemia or anemia. They need blood products. Gunshot violence depletes blood banks of resources needed to treat our patients. We should be somewhat concerned about the use of blood products for people who otherwise are healthy, except they've been shot. It should be part of our conversation.
What physicians do in their personal life is their own decision. The issue that I disagree with is a professional medical organization making a political statement on a political issue.
I would like to think that there's enough concern about gun violence and not just within suicide. When parents send their kids off to school, they're not worried a child will commit suicide. When people are going to their house of worship, they're not thinking of suicide as a problem. People are worried that violence is going to enter their house of worship. These things are of a pressing social problem.
I do agree with you that if you listen to the news, gun violence is something that parents are concerned about. But it is also important that we be factually accurate. It is true to state that the vast majority of mortality from gun violence is suicide. Two-thirds in the year 2017, 60% in 2016. It is concerning when you hear this in news reports. Believe me, nobody is advocating for more people to die from guns. But I also think it is important that we be honest about why most people die from gun violence, and that is suicide.
The Hippocratic Oath commands physicians to, above all else, do no harm. But one can do harm by omitting a voice in public discussion. I think we're both saying the same thing. There's nothing in the Hippocratic Oath pertaining to gun violence exactly, but physicians should always advocate for a safer society.
Yes, the first written record of the Hippocratic Oath is from the year 275, so of course there was nothing mentioned regarding gun control. And from a larger social perspective, should physicians be involved in population health? Absolutely. I would not argue against that. It is an important area of research. It contributes to large changes in care, delivery of care, and quality of life. I do believe that physicians have a social obligation to improve population health, but at the end of the day, people have different thoughts and ideas. As people who are involved in science and research, we should be prepared for the fact that people don't always agree. No one who has goodness in their heart wishes for more death from gun violence. And that's the end of the piece and the contributions from each of those two hematologists. Natalie, we purposefully did not speak about this article or those positions before we started recording so that I could ask you, what's your initial take on what we just read?
I think they're both correct. But I do think my character, I think he's trying to say that you need to take a stand, and that organizations should not, that being quiet is doing harm.
What's your thought on this idea that gun control is a political issue?
I mean, it is a political issue, but it's also a health issue. All health issues are political issues.
Can anyone really argue that gun violence isn't a problem? I mean, every metric bears it out. Every single metric, that the general gun violence in the United States is a major problem. We should be somewhat concerned about the use of blood products for people who are otherwise healthy, except that they have been shot. I think that's my biggest takeaway, is that from a healthcare perspective,
from a hematologist perspective,
that gunshot wounds, they see a dramatic amount of blood loss and usage of blood and blood component resources to treat victims of gun violence, when there are places that have patients with chronic illnesses who require those blood products to sustain their life. I don't see how that isn't a health problem, and I don't see how the government shouldn't be protecting the point that was made in here about, you know, research. Why is one amendment to an omnibus spending bill from 22 years ago dictating the fact that we can't even research these topics? Like, how insane is that? If you just remove yourself from being a part of the United States in 2019, one of the five largest countries in the world, the most powerful country in the world, we can't even do research on guns when we have an epidemic unlike any other country. It's just befuddling.
Yeah, it is befuddling. And it is interesting too, you know, Dr. Scott, I think he's very nervous about, you know, he makes the point many times that he doesn't care what individuals do, but that it becomes problematic when professional societies take positions. And I think that there's a little cowardice in that.
I think there's a little cowardice in that too. I definitely agree with you on that. I also want to just go back to something from the beginning of this article. A February 2019 study analyzed campaign contributions from the 25 largest physician organization affiliated political action committees, or PACs. So physician organization affiliated PACs, to see if their established positions on firearm safety aligned with their support for political candidates. These physician-affiliated PACs gave more money to political candidates who oppose evidence-based policies to reduce firearm-related injuries than to those who support such policies. According to its authors, the study is not meant to suggest that these groups actively sought to support these candidates because of their firearm policies, but that these PACs have not yet made candidates' stances on firearm policy a high-priority issue, which is kind of interesting. So the 25 largest physician-organization-affiliated PACs, February 2019, just a few months ago, the study of those 25 contributions, the results, at least, you know, take them for what they're worth, that basically these PACs don't prioritize gun safety. That was their takeaway, which is also kind of interesting. You know, and Dr. Scott also made the point that we have to be careful about the language we use. And he suggested that there's discussion around gun control that could potentially, this was my takeaway anyway, hurt efforts for suicide prevention. Like, I kind of felt as though some of what's in here feels as though he senses as a little bit of a fiefdom, or though as though it's a zero-sum game. We can either look at gun violence and murders, or we can look at suicide. And again, we have to walk and chew gum. We can look at both. But if we're not even allowing ourselves to adequately research these things, then what are we even really looking at?
And I think, you know, how the article wraps up too, you know, they are, they're both saying, you know, no one wishes for more deaths from gun violence. You know, no physician is like, yeah, yeah, right. Great. Keep them coming into the emergency room. Nobody wants that. And especially with the trending social media campaign last year, This Is Our Lane. You know, I remember, or this year, earlier this year, I remember seeing that pop up. And, you know, I have a mother who works in the emergency department, and it's 100% her lane.
She's at the Cleveland Clinic of all places, too.
She's dealing with gunshot wounds quite often. And to say that's not their lane, or they're not affected by it, or they don't see it. And then, you know, the further the drain on the resources of, you know, blood is a finite resource and blood banks, and to not have that available for people who, outside of being shot, would otherwise be, or for using those resources for people who outside of the gunshot wound would otherwise be healthy, feels like a misappropriation of resources.
And if you look at it from that perspective, maybe it helps to shift the way that we discuss this, so it's not as heated an issue that never allows for nuanced conversation.
Yeah. All right. And it's hard to extract, you know, the highly politicized playground it's in right now in this country, and, you know, how it is, it feels like a partisan issue. And when we're looking at it through the lens of healthcare, can we look at it as a bipartisan issue?
Well, you know, to that point, the fact that the Dr. Scott was able to cite the research that led to the conclusion that suicide and suicide attempts in 2015 cost a total of $93.5 billion. Well, how much money does gun violence, and how much money do mass shootings, if we want to separate a little bit, what does that cost? And do we want to look at this from a financial point of view? And if we look at it from a financial point of view, does it enable us to have versions of the conversation that feel more accessible and safer without skirting the fact that we have something very, very disturbing to talk about? I don't know. But it does, to your point, it does feel beneficial to be considering perhaps gun violence and gun control, gun safety, maybe not from a public health standpoint, but from a financial standpoint. It's at least worth a try, because the argument as has been tried does not seem to be moving much by way of legislation. We will have a link to the article in the program notes. Again, from ASH Clinical News, Is Gun Control a Healthcare Issue? Okay, you've heard me talk about him before on the Bloodstream podcast and his mission to combat fake health news online. I'm joined now by Dr. Austin Cheng. Dr. Cheng, how are you this morning?
I'm great. Thanks for having me on the podcast.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure. So as I mentioned, listeners will have heard us talk about you previously, are a little bit familiar with your mission, but just as a way to kind of table set for us, can you tell me what it is that you are doing and what got you started doing it?
Yeah, so I am a full-time practicing doctor on social media. I'm not the first to be doing this. You know, there have been doctors who've been on social media for the past decade or so, since the inception of social media, really. But many of us are on there to educate and really lend an accurate voice by talking about the things that we're trained to talk about, or the things that we're trained to do. And so I'd like to encourage more clinicians to get online to participate in that dialogue, so that we can sort of set the record straight and be able to provide accurate medical information from our own perspective, rather than have other people who might not have the training do that for us. And likewise, I want to make sure that those physicians and health professionals who are getting online for the time, who aren't used to using social media, aren't falling into certain pitfalls or making mistakes that could potentially jeopardize their professional development, or potentially sort of build on the distrust that's already existing out there for the medical community.
You mentioned how you're not the first doctor to be doing this. Was there a particular trigger for you, or what got you in particular started?
Yeah, for me, a couple of years ago, I was curious to understand how the general public receives medical information and medical knowledge. And so I spent some time with the ABC News medical unit to really see how the primary literature was being vetted by the network before the information made its way onto being used. And in that process, saw how social media was being used. And at the time, ABC was hosting weekly Twitter chats. And I could see how really important public figures and representatives of medical organizations were jumping online to participate in this dialogue. And that's when I really thought to myself, hey, I want to use this productively in my own way. And so that's how I started getting engaged and started talking about my own area of expertise, which is gastroenterology. At the time, I was a trainee. And started getting my fellow gastroenterologists involved and doing research using social media data. And ultimately, one thing to another, and now that's led to my position as Chief Medical Social Media Officer at Jefferson in Philadelphia, one of the big academic centers here, as well as the founding president of the Association for Healthcare Social Media, which is the first professional society devoted to health professional use of social media.
And what was your inspiration to start that organization? Because I would imagine the position at Jefferson, in addition to your practice, would have been plenty to keep you busy and give you an opportunity to make a difference and influence social media's use in healthcare. Why did you go that additional step?
Yeah, it's definitely those other roles would have kept me plenty busy. But it's mainly because me, along with several other physicians who are on Instagram mainly, we've seen a huge surge in health professionals getting on Instagram. Now, I know a lot of health professionals, physicians, nurses, et cetera, have been on Twitter for a long time, and it's sort of become an academic forum there. But on Instagram, with fashion influencers and fitness influencers and all these sorts of influencers that you see on there, the wave is sort of hitting health professionals, and we're seeing how the platform is really being used in a lot of different ways that is sometimes concerning and sometimes highlights certain aspects of social media use that have been concerning to us. And one of those a couple months ago was misrepresentation. We started seeing how students were sort of misrepresenting themselves as full-fledged physicians and nurses, and I'm not exactly sure what the motivation behind that necessarily is. But we also saw sort of other allied health professionals like chiropractors saying that they were physicians and just sort of misrepresenting themselves rather than owning up to what their own area of expertise is. And so we wanted to really highlight how that was an issue. So we had a hashtag campaign a couple months ago called hashtag verify healthcare, where we encouraged those medical influencers, health professionals with large followings to disclose their credentials and their training so that their followers could be informed about what areas they were actually trained to speak about. And likewise, encourage those followers to double and triple check who they were trusting online. And that ultimately led to this bigger idea that, you know, there should be a professional society out there not only to provide resources and define these best practices of social media use by health professionals, but also to sort of legitimize what we're doing here. We're spending a lot of time using these platforms to communicate with one another, to communicate with patients. And this is, if this is where patients are getting medical information from these days, we really want to legitimize this practice and make sure that, you know, it's recognized as something important, something that's worthwhile spending our time on.
So to that end, how does that Association of Healthcare Social Media, how does it evolve? How have people gotten involved? And what's your vision for it over the coming years?
Yeah, I mean, it's brand new. So we just launched about 2 months ago. So it's very fresh out the gate. We'd like to see it grow like any other medical society out there, having annual events, having courses, having, you know, the resources that I had talked about and best practices defined so that people can refer to them and better utilize social media and not fall into traps and use it effectively, not just responsibly. And my hope is that, you know, we can partner with medical institutions and medical schools and other sort of organizations out there, medical societies, to work together to make sure that everyone is well informed about how to do these things on social media effectively and responsibly.
You mentioned communicating with patients earlier. I imagine that the communication with patients on social media platforms is a unique way of communicating with patients, even beyond obviously the direct pinging messaging system that has been used quite ubiquitously, it seems, in the last number of years. That's a form of e-communication, but it's still private. It's still between you and the doctor. How do you think about your communication when you're, say, responding to an Instagram comment that someone has about a certain element of gastroenterology, for example?
Yeah, I think we have to be very careful about the fine line between education and medical advice. And as a bottom line, I really make sure that I don't cross that boundary. I don't provide individualized medical advice over the internet. In some ways, I feel like it's doing a patient a disservice if I were to do that without the full picture, without seeing someone in person. And so there is a very fine line there. At the same time, I recognize how the way we're communicating with patients today is very different than how it was 10 years ago or 20 years ago. Nowadays, I think once upon a time, we probably discouraged email sort of communication, but now we're directly communicating with patients through our electronic medical records. Telehealth is being incentivized by a lot of medical institutions, including our own. And so how we're communicating with patients is changing. And I feel that social media is just another way for us to connect with patients and develop that sort of loyalty with one another. And not necessarily communicate directly at this point in time. Maybe that'll evolve as time goes on. But if patients do have a question, sort of a general question about something that I'm talking about education-wise, I'm happy to answer that. But if it's something individualized relating to their own personal care, I definitely draw the line there.
I like the ease of the distinction you made between education and advice and what you just said there at the end. If it's about someone's particular circumstances, it feels like then it starts to move into that realm of advice where you draw that line. Once it gets particular, moves a bit out of the realm of education and becomes more specific to that patient, now we're in the gray area. Is that an accurate way of kind of contextualizing it?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And I think that, you know, sometimes even if it's a very simple question that seems like it could be addressed, everyone's medical circumstances are very different. And, you know, it could be easily misconstrued over the internet in a very short comment or message. So it's best to always see a patient in person and actually communicate with them that way.
So sticking to the Association for Healthcare Social Media, which is a nonprofit organization, right? That's correct?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So a nonprofit organization, how many, and like you said, it's 2 months into its lifespan. So that's important to note. But even that said, how many clinicians are a part of the association in one way or another as of today?
As of today, we're looking at over 500 new members. The core group of us who started the organization, there are about 15 of us board of directors. But for the members who have just joined, we're currently organizing into committees to focus on various aspects. I think that right now our focus will be on developing those best practices. So I think that that's where a lot of people want to see, you know, us sort of define how best to use social media, what the responsible ways of using it are. So that's what we're working on right now. And like I mentioned earlier, I think that in the future, we'd like to have sort of our inaugural event sometime soon. Originally, it was going to be later this year, but I think that we're going to probably have it sometime early next year.
Patient education is a topic that's been of particular interest to me in the last couple of years as more of my work has started to get outside of the U.S. and appreciating that within the U.S., the amount of education that's available for patients, the amount of engagement that a patient may have with a drug maker or a biotech company directly and representatives from that company, there's just much more conversation that patients in the U.S. are a part of as it pertains to their health than, say, in Europe, it seems to me. I'm curious to know, from your perspective, are there any challenges with the degree to which patients are a part of the decision-making process of their own care? I know that sounds a little crazy to say it that way, but it does seem to me as though there are systems where the patient has less let's say, day-to-day or week-to-week choice or access, so to speak, than they do here in the U.S. And I would just be curious to hear your perspective on that.
I think that's really interesting. You know, I spent part of my life growing up in Taiwan, where it's a single-payer health system. And unlike the U.S., there's no direct-to-consumer pharmaceutical marketing there. And I feel that in some ways, it's a cultural thing, like what you were saying, that patients aren't really encouraged or don't have that cultural foundation to say, you know, I'm going to take control of my own care and I'm going to look everything up myself. So I think that that's a really good thing. I definitely encourage my patients to be advocates for their own care and to be well-informed and to read up as much as they can. But at the same time, this is my concern about the information that's out there. You know, on the internet, there's just a quick Google search could take you down many different paths. And when we're talking about a single medical condition, there could be a lot of variation depending on what context it's interpreted in. And that's sort of the job that we have as medical professionals, to help interpret that information. And so there's also just a lot of misinformation and disinformation out there. And that's the whole purpose, I think, of making sure that more health professionals who are trained to talk about these issues and these conditions to be speaking up and spending time on social media and contributing to health journalism, so that we can provide the most accurate voice out there, rather than have other sort of untrained individuals, bloggers, et cetera, do that for us.
And those bloggers and untrained individuals, some of them may even be patient advocates. And I know within the hemophilia world, there are plenty of patients or caregivers or spouses who are quite active, interested in sharing their information, interested in closed Facebook groups where they can try to give some guidance to a mother who maybe takes a picture of a bruise to say, have you ever seen bruising like this on your hemophiliac son? There's obviously benefit to this type of direct engagement with other patients, caregivers, what have you, that P2P connection. But in there, there's also so much opportunity for incorrect information, for something framed as education when maybe it was actually medical advice for your particular circumstance, to go back to what we were saying just a few minutes ago. How do you see that part of the online communication world working in unison with your efforts and also simultaneously being a bit of a challenge? Because as I said, these are in many cases not necessarily capital E experts, but they do have a lot of value to add. So it's a gray area in my mind.
Yeah, I totally agree. There's a lot of value to having that, the sort of closed Facebook groups and the patient-to-patient conversation and the community that's built there. I think that you also mentioned a really great word about, you know, acting in unison. I think that's very critical. And I know that the patient advocates who are very vocal and active in our field are very good at integrating themselves with the professionals. And I know many of them personally at this point have met them at conferences. And there have been moments where actually there have been several people who've left comments on my Instagram profile, for instance, trying to disclaim some of the things that I'm talking about. And I've had the patient advocates come in and sort of talk about their own experiences to justify the facts that I'm putting out there and why there's certain, you know, treatments that are beneficial, et cetera. And so I think if we can work together, us being able to work with the patient advocates to lend a more, you know, patient-centered perspective. At the same time, you know, the patient advocates also recognizing the value of medical professionals and recognizing how we're there. Many of us are accessible and willing to, you know, provide that sort of expertise whenever it's asked of us. I think that would also be really great.
And to that end, for patients and advocates who are listening and interested in supporting what you're doing but aren't themselves clinicians, what can a patient or an advocate or a non-medical person who's interested in supporting your work, what can they do?
Yeah, so actually interesting that you bring that up, because our organization, the Association for Healthcare Social Media, which you can find at ahsm.org, The intention initially was to only open it up to clinicians and health professionals, but we're increasingly recognizing how patient advocates are a very important part of this entire picture. And there are other sort of allied health professionals or folks who are involved in other aspects of healthcare who are out there talking about health topics, who really should be involved in this as well and should be held to the same sort of elevated standard of how we're utilizing social media. So I think that we're going to better define that moving forward so that patient advocates are welcome in the organization. And like I said, I think that it's really, if you are a patient advocate for a specific condition, I think it's best to identify who is out there, putting themselves out there on social media in that field, in that specialty, because those folks are more than likely the ones who are accessible because they're willing to put themselves out there and willing to communicate. And I'm sure that there could be great collaboration and potential for synergy there.
So that website again is AHSM, the Association for Healthcare Social Media, AHSM.org. You can email info@AHSM.org if you'd like to follow up on any or all of this incredible mission and how you could potentially help. Before we part ways, Dr. Chang, and thank you for your time. I appreciate you making the time to talk more with us about this. But I wanted to ask you personally, you got into medicine, I doubt, with an intention of being where you are today with regard to social media education and decluttering the social media disinformation. What initially got you interested in medicine and GI? Where did that come from?
Oh, that's a really loaded question. For me, it was really a journey of discovery. It wasn't something that I knew from the get-go what sort of doctor I wanted to be, what specialty I wanted to enter, what path I wanted to take. I entered medicine mainly because I had family members in medicine who I looked up to, who I felt I had the same sort of personality fit for the field. And I did explore throughout college different areas that I potentially would be interested in. And I think medicine ended up just being a good combination of patient engagement plus science. And from there, in trying to figure out what I wanted to do in terms of subspecializing, gastroenterology, ultimately, it's a very popular field. I don't know if many people know that, but it's a very popular field these days because it's a really great balance between procedures and medicine, sort of cerebral medical thinking. And on top of that, there's just so much variety. If you can imagine all the different organs in your abdomen, there are so many, there's just a lot of variety there. It ranges anywhere from liver transplantation to bile duct issues to, you know, colon cancer. And so it really spans the whole gamut. And what I ended up doing within gastroenterology is advanced endoscopy. And that is it's a very procedurally heavy aspect within gastroenterology that focuses on the diagnosis and treatment of many different types of issues, including pancreatic cancer. And from there, another niche area within this is obesity and the treatment, endoscopic treatments that are performed through the mouth to address weight loss. So that's my area within this giant field that I'm really focused on clinically.
Well, interesting to get that bit of background. And you can learn more about Dr. Austin Chang as well as his work with the Association of Healthcare for Social Media online. He's available. You're on Instagram. You mentioned Twitter, LinkedIn. Are you a Facebook user as well?
I am. I do have a Facebook page as well, so you can find me there. I'm on YouTube as well. You can go ahead and subscribe to me there. I'm on virtually every social media platform that you can think of.
And we'll have links in the program notes as well to make it all the easier. Dr. Chang, thank you again. And if there are any updates along the way, if you would like to come back or if you even want to just shoot me an email with a link to something you think listeners might be interested in, consider us an ally as well. And anything we can do to help with communication, we will do.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Once again, the presenting sponsor of the Bloodstream podcast is Takeda. And for that, we say...
Thanks, Takeda.
And now it's time for Mama Sue's Netflix Recs. But just one more time, I want to thank our presenting sponsor, Takeda, for making the Bloodstream podcast possible. And you can find out more about what else they make possible at bleedingdisorders.com. Hi, Mom. How are you?
Hi, honey. How are you doing?
I'm good. We had a nice weekend this past weekend. We got to see each other at a wedding up in Canada. That was fun.
Yes, up in Whistler Mountain. We had a great few days, that's for sure. I loved it.
It was really beautiful. I've never quite been in a place like Whistler between the mountains and the woods that were there. It was a very unique environment, especially in the summer.
Yes, I agree. Very unique. And I would recommend it to anyone. And if you like winter sports, it's very good for the winter sports, but summer is fantastic.
So I'm glad to hear you still had time to do your homework, that the wedding and the travel didn't throw you off. We have three recommendations to make for people. Where do you want to start this week or this month, I should say?
Well, the first one I'd like to talk about is from Netflix. It's called In the Dark. I think it's a relatively new release. It's 13 episodes. It's only one season. And it's about a blind woman investigating her friend's murder because she doesn't feel anything's being done. And it was very different, you know, if you like those murder mysteries, which I do. But it was just different being a blind woman. And it's funny and it's sad and it's suspenseful. And I really liked it, and I would recommend it to people.
What are some of the ways, because you do watch, you like that genre, and so to say it's different, obviously her being blind, you know, okay, I get that that means there's going to be some different stuff, but what are some of the differences that stuck out to you or that you found memorable about this particular show?
Well, of course, she's, you know, the police are pretty much not even thinking her friend is dead, and so she's out there with her stick and her dog trying to find clues and this, that, and the other, and she has relationship issues and she has personal issues and she has family issues. And so many different things going on in the series, which I liked. It's not just straight murder investigations.
And you'll be happy to hear, too, it was renewed for a second season in April. So it will have a second season. So there's some good news for you.
I'm not surprised. I'm not a bit surprised. That's good. Yeah, I would recommend it. You should watch it yourself.
I will. It sounds interesting. I've heard it. Someone else mentioned it to me as well recently. I think it's one of those shows that now that it's been out for a couple of months, it's starting to gain some audiences. And it only just ended. The finale was only on June 27th. So, you know, a little over a month ago, a month and a half ago.
Oh, I didn't even realize that.
Yeah. So a very current one for you, which is, you know, you're not always as current. You like to go back. You like to go overseas. You like to go everywhere with what you're watching.
That's true. Well, the next one is overseas. The next one is overseas.
All right. Well, let's get to it.
The next one is also Netflix. It's called Father Brown Mysteries, and it takes place.
I like that title, Father Brown Mysteries or Father Brown. I think it's called Father Brown.
Well, Father Brown, but it's mysteries.
Got it.
He's a little country priest in England, and he is solving crime, investigating missing persons and murder in England in the 50s. And it's very nice because if you're a reader, I mean, they refer to them as cozy mysteries. Like, there's no blood, there's no gore. It's almost like a family show, honestly. And everything gets wrapped up in each episode. And I like it very much. There's six seasons and there's probably 10 episodes per season. I watched this over a couple of months. And I like it a lot, and I think I would recommend it.
It's interesting that you say that it's, what's that word you use? There's no blood, there's no gore. What was the genre word you used?
I don't remember what I said.
There's a word in like the novel world.
Oh, cozy mysteries.
Cozy mysteries. Yeah, well, it's interesting you say that. I'm reading here on Wikipedia. BBC Daytime wanted a homegrown detective show for the afternoons on BBC. So it generated from a desire to have exactly that. So it sounds like they were successful in trying to carry that out. How would you compare this as a mystery detective show? How would you compare Father Brown to In the Dark?
Well, Father Brown always gets the man or the woman. I mean, he always comes out on top. In the Dark is not true. There's, you know, it doesn't always wrap up nicely each episode. Father Brown is just each 45 minute episode ends nicely, which I like.
I see. Okay. And she's pursuing one case and In the Dark. It's one case, her friend, and Father Brown, it's a different case every episode?
every episode, and his housekeeper cook is his partner, and they butt heads with the local policeman because they're butting in, and they're, of course, Father Brown is always right. So
that's one of my favorite things. It's every TV show, every movie, there's always like the local cops, but then the FBI gets involved, or it's like the state police get involved when the city had it under their jurisdiction. I always like that part of the show or the movie where the cops start fighting with the other cops because everybody's getting kind of territorial about the case. That's always a fun part of all those. You know it's coming. You always know it's coming. As the people you're following are getting closer, it's like it's only a matter of time before the federal agents get involved and screw it all up. And it always happens.
Well, Father Brown manages to solve all the big crimes in England and the countryside.
He is superb. Good job. I think he either chose correctly by becoming a priest who solved crimes, or he missed his true calling. You can tell us when you finish the show. And what is our third show for this month?
Well, the third one I watched is Amazon. It's called Is Sugar the New Fat? I believe it's a couple of years old.
This is going to be depressing, isn't it?
Well, this documentarian believes that sugar is the devil in our diet. Whereas a few months ago, I forget the name of the one I talked about, but they were talking about fat being the culprit, not so much sugar. So this was filmed, I think, in New Zealand. This doctor believes it's sugar. And the reason they said that there's so much sugar, like a small bottle of ketchup has 16 added teaspoons of sugar. Things you know, sugary sodas and sugary cake and things, you know that sugar is in those things. But there's so much added sugar in things you don't think have sugar.
Right.
If you read the label. And this doctor said, you know, in the 70s, when they talked about, you know, saturated fats and they removed all these things from processed foods, the food tasted like cardboard. So they had to add sugar, and they added sugar to take over the taste with the fat. And I know this is true from when I worked in the clinic at my hospital. Like children 2 and 3 are having their teeth rotted and they're having their teeth pulled out when they're just barely in. And, it is quite a problem. I mean, there is a genetic component to having weak teeth that are cavity prone, but also some of these children are just eating too much and drinking too much sugar. And they show them pulling the teeth, which is kind of gory, but and jeez, child screaming, of course.
Okay, so thanks for confirming that I won't be watching this.
And then they did basically say, yes, sugar is super addictive, physically addictive, which I kind of knew. I knew that personally.
Have you felt that way before, like with your own sugar consumption?
I do crave sugar sometimes. Yes, I do. I must have it.
Yeah, me too. Me too.
I must have it. I don't feel like that with anything else, just sugar.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so Natalie and I will go through bouts where, especially if we're traveling a lot, we'll be a little bit more indulgent with like, let's get some gummy worms or I want to get a quick ice cream. And, you know, we work out a lot. So we're not always like as concerned about it from like a caloric intake standpoint. But we wind up getting into like some bad patterns where after 4 or 5 days of travel, come home and it's like, should we get some more ice cream? You want to get a Baskin Robbins pizza cake? It's like the inner addict is like, oh, sugar, sugar, sugar. And it takes a couple few days, but then I notice like that goes away. And that's what's telling me it's like, it's an addictive thing because after a couple few days where I finally find some discipline, it goes away.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. You get over it. And
it's not a biological need.
This doctor was saying that, he feels the government should intervene because he said, you know, you can't make someone be active. You can't judge, you can't supervise people's portion control. And those are two things. It's not all about the sugar. You must be active and you must eat reasonable portions. But this doctor believes that it's a national, in New Zealand anyway, but it's global. It's a global problem. You can, you know, control the amount of added sugar into things we buy. So we probably wouldn't be buying processed food if they didn't add the sugar since they're not adding much fat anymore. So it won't taste very good without the sugar.
And you also know exactly what's going into the food that you eat at home that you've made or your partner's made or someone in the household's made. I feel like I've heard that said over and over, whether it's trying to avoid gluten or trying to avoid sugar or trying to whatever the case is, you know, we are for it. Depends on where you live a little bit, but fortunately, there's more and more sensitivities around food restrictions and food preferences, especially in a place like Los Angeles, as people would probably assume. But it also does, I do feel like I hear repetitively, if you're making your food at home, then you know exactly what's going into it. You're preparing it fresh. You know the ingredients. You know what's in your body. And of course, where are you still sourcing what you're purchasing from? There's a whole, you know, it kind of never ends in a way. If we should all just start growing our own food.
And eat grass. That's basically all we can do. But I don't know if you were part of the conversation in Vancouver. My brother Michael went into a restaurant and ordered a medium rare hamburger, and they said rare is illegal in Vancouver.
Oh, the airport gave me some. Yeah, the airport had a like canned line where I was like, I get that medium rare. She's like, we actually can't cook to temperature, but the burger is this, that, guaranteed to not affect flavor. It was like, oh, this is the thing you say when Americans come asking for a burger a certain way. So I guess it's a thing in all of Vancouver and maybe all of British Columbia. I don't know, maybe all of Canada. You'll have to let us know.
Well, I was surprised that they still serve the sushi, you know, with the raw fish, because I mean, that would carry germs also. But yeah. You're allowed to eat sushi, but you can't eat a rare hamburger. So it's kind of strange.
Have you ever noticed how sometimes laws don't really make a lot of sense?
I must say I have, my dear.
Mom, thank you as always for coming on and sharing what you're watching with the audience. People enjoy hearing from you, and I enjoy talking to you for the podcast. So thanks.
Excellent, honey. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Okay, episode 39, Parting Shots. Something to leave you listeners with, bleeding disorders related or not, although I think it's going to be bleeding disorders related this week because we just decided what we're going to talk about here. Go ahead, Natalie.
So earlier this month, we went to Whistler for Patrick's cousin's wedding.
Whistler.
And it was everything everyone says it would be.
A gorgeous place.
Yeah, it's so beautiful. I believe temperate forests, which a really small percentage of forestry in the world is that type of forest. And yeah, it was really just like so pretty. So we took on this really ambitious hike.
Yeah.
That ended up being a little bit over 8 miles round trip.
It was a pretty steep uphill hike too.
Oh,
well,
very
four up. And four, I guess, but it was a steep one.
I mean, in some of the coming down, we were holding onto chains as we came down some slate. Mm-hmm. Like it was labeled difficult.
It was labeled difficult.
And,
it was moderate.
And it left us both, kind of sore and you a little banged up. You want to tell the Bloodstream community about what was a first for you this weekend?
Yes. So, you know, we went on this hike Friday. My cousin's wedding was Saturday. And I was cognizant. We talked about this going into the week. Like, I just want to be mindful of my activity. Let's not overbook ourselves doing things this weekend and blah, blah, blah. But we were both amped for this hike. We got new shoes for it and everything. But yeah, it left me pretty banged up. To be honest, I am not entirely sure how much of my experience was arthritic and how much of it was bleeding related. But by the end of that night, unfortunately, I was like so rough, I couldn't really walk. So I was crawling to and from the bathroom, from the bed. And as other hemos out there. Well, this is really funny, guys, because this wedding, like everybody traveled from Whistler. So there was something Friday night, Saturday night, and Sunday. Friday, we show up, and Friday, I'm actually doing good. And we're talking about the hike because, like, you know,
we'd just done it.
And people knew, my mom knew we were going on, we were talking about it, and like we're moving around fine. Saturday rolls around, and I'm like a little worse for wear at the beginning of the morning. Like, you know, when you wake up just like real stiff and creaky and if you have any kind of bleeding going on, plus whatever was going on with me. But Natalie and I have been talking about my wanting to maybe at some point pick up some kind of cane, because this isn't the first time that I've had some kind of issue where my mobility was challenged. And like, if she and I are together, you know, we'll hold hands and she'll kind of use that to give me a little extra support and I can sneak a little support. But it happens, I guess, often enough that it was going to be time sooner or later to get something that I could not use. Like, I don't anticipate using this often, but using it when I need it. So Saturday showed up at the wedding in our wedding clothes. I got a suit
black tie
and a bow tie. Yeah, a black tie wedding. And suddenly I'm walking around with this 3-foot like wooden Gandalf staff. And people are like, what happened to you? Where'd that
come
from?
What is this accessory?
And so I was like, what's the simplest? Cause you know how it is. Even in my own family, like outside of my mom, I'm not even really trying to explain hemophilia and like arthritis and bleeds, and it's just complicated. But then again, and then Sunday we show back up to the next thing and I'm walking just fine. By the time Sunday night rolled around for that thing, I was doing great. So nobody really like said anything or whatnot, but I was reminded of those days in school where I would go to school one day, I'd come in the next day in a wheelchair or on crutches, I'd come in the day after that, nothing. The day after that, my arm is in a sling. Like during the inhibitor years, it would just sometimes be wild. And people are like, what's going on with this guy? And it's just how it goes. So I had a little taste of that this weekend. And I got myself this cane that I'm looking at right now, which, you know, it looks pretty cool. The airport was like, what are you doing? I'm like, I got a cane. It just looks cooler.
Yeah, it's super cool. And I'm glad that, you know, we had talked about it. And, you know, from a spouse perspective, this was probably the most debilitating bleed arthritic episode that I've witnessed.
Was it? I didn't even think about that.
When we first started dating, you had gone on a run that kind of, you attempted to go on a run that sort of...
tail end of my running days, probably.
Yeah, it is the last time I'd ever seen you attempt to run, and it landed you on crutches for a couple of days. But I was kind of in and out. And this was, yeah, by far the most debilitated. And it is interesting when you describe it, saying like I was using the cane and then the next day I was walking quite well. But yeah, when you were at the peak of your pain, it was pretty intense. And it makes me feel good to know that you have this device. And, you know, for when I'm not around, we are separate a lot and we travel, and I'm happy you have it, and it's cool looking. I like, you know.
Yeah.
Canes can be cool.
I'm leaning into my cool cane, whatever.
Is this a shared parting shot, or do you have something you want to share?
Well, I mean, this is literally the one time I had a parting shot weeks in advance.
Oh, okay. So, Patrick, what Look. Is your August 2019 parting shot?
All right. So, get this. There's a lot of drugs in the world. They got all kinds of crazy names, right? Well, it turns out that most generic drug names, like where do they come from, you wonder? They're somewhat randomly chosen by basically these two ladies. There's two ladies who are in charge of basically every new generic drug name. And that's all I'm going to tell you. You're going to have to click the link in the program notes to find out more, because that is all for this episode. Special thanks to everyone at Believe Limited, at the National Hemophilia Foundation, Entertainment to Effect Change, the Hemophilia Alliance, and our presenting sponsor, Takeda, as well as to our Like Segment sponsor, Genentech. Challenge accepted, Joe. Thanks as well to segment contributors Debbie De La Riva, Amy Board, Meredith Myers, Dr. Austin Chang, and Mama Sue Lynch. Subscribe to the Bloodstream Podcast, the Ask the Expert Podcast, and you may as well to the Bloodline Podcast, because you got to catch that inhibitor series coming up. They're on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Spotify, you know the drill. Help spread the word, leave us ratings, share the show. You can email us, mailbag@bloodstreammedia.com, or on facebook.com/bloodstreammedia, on Twitter @bloodstreaminfo. Reminder to check out the program notes for this episode in your podcast player, or on bloodstreampod.com for links and additional information about the various stories featured on this episode. My name is Patrick James Lynch.
And I'm Natalie Lynch.
And until next time, take self-care of yourself. Bye, everybody.